On this edition of Stack Overflow, Joel and Jeff discuss MacBook Air overheating and undervolting, constructive criticism, and they engage in an extended discussion of Joel's management training program reading list. If you love classic books, this is the podcast you've been looking for, from IT Conversations. Hi, this is Phil Windley. Today I'm excited to bring you another great program from Stack Overflow with Joel Spolsky and Jeff Atwood here on IT Conversations.
The Conversations Network is a 501c3 nonprofit, and we need your help. For a tax-deductible donation of as little as $5 per month, you can support this channel and the rest of the Conversations Network. So please visit conversationsnetwork.org to become a member and help us continue to bring our programs to the world for free. Our audio files are delivered by Limelight Networks, the high-performance content delivery network for digital media.
And now, here's Stack Overflow.
I've heard of this podcast thing. I think we should get on top of this hot new trend while it's still cool and all.
Okay.
Yeah. So this week was a short week.
It was?
Largely because I had a little bit of, well, it was for me because I had a vacation thing.
Oh.
I went to Iowa with my wife.
What's the thing they say now? You're not doing it right.
What do you mean?
The vacation. Hawaii. Oh. Even yes. San Diego, if you're in California, it's close. The Caribbean, Europe, Australia.
Well, this was a family thing. This was one of those required events. It was in Des Moines. It was nice. I mean, Des Moines, uh-huh. Nice. It's got a really nice 50s-style architecture there. It's not a bad place.
50s-style architecture? It doesn't sound like a real thing.
Yeah.
Anything? Okay.
It's off the beaten track. I like Americana, and I like people from the Midwest. My wife is from the Midwest. They're actually very, very nice people. But one thing that happened to me while I was flying out is I'd forgotten how difficult it is to actually work on an airplane with your laptop. It's pretty much impossible. Yeah. I guess unless you're in first class or something.
You have to have the X, like the IBM X series, the really small ones.
Well, mine is the XPS 1330, which is an ultra portable. It's like a 3-pound laptop. It's a 13-inch screen. And
that should work.
It should work. But the people in front of me reclined. And I got to tell you, it's really – you're allowed to recline, right? It's a built-in feature of the airplane. But it's really hard not to resent the people who sit in front of you and decide to recline because it's trying to work on your laptop.
Yeah, it's just not fair on a short flight.
Yeah. Yeah, so that was awkward. But I did get to, you know, actually work on some Stack Overflow code, believe it or not, while I was on the plane. A few little minor things I checked in.
All right.
Yeah, yeah. Subversion has really good offline support, which is really nice. Easy to appreciate that on an airplane.
Have you ever heard – wait, Subversion has what? Huh?
Offline. Well, Subversion is a very good offline client.
It does?
In other words, totally. Yeah, as long as you're not trying to check anything in.
Oh, but then you don't get the benefit of source code control while you're disconnected.
Well, yeah, that's a good point. And I think that's one of the things about the distributed version controls that they sort of get you on the right path is like they're versioning everything you do. And if you think about what's happening, it's like, well, why not just version every time I save the file, right, internally, and just give me like an audit rollback of every, you know, kind of like the undo buffer that's in there.
There's certain points that you want to declare as like, this is a major point. I'm about to do something crazy. I may want to go back to this restore point.
Sure.
So you want to be able to establish that one of those particular undo points is more significant than all the little undo points.
Well, sure. But I think all those little undo points can be useful at times too. It's like in the computer, you know, computers have like so much space and power. It's like, why not just track everything I'm doing?
Yeah.
Not necessarily check it in per se, but give me like a local audit trail that's like written to disk that's not lost. You know, because mm-hmm. Visual Studio's undo is great, but it's like it's only like per file. And if you close Visual Studio or Visual Studio crashes, you lose your undo buffers and things like that.
So. Absolutely. While we're talking about laptops on planes, have you ever heard of undervolting?
I have.
You have?
I do.
You do?
Yeah. Well, I'm a hardware, you know, enthusiast.
I thought I had discovered something nobody else knew.
No, undervolting is really cool. That's just a way – so power usage of a chip is like the square of the voltage. It's also related to speed, obviously, if you have like a 5 gigahertz chip, but it goes up like much more, it tracks much more strongly with voltage. Mm-hmm. So you can get huge power savings by reducing the voltage at which the chip runs.
Yeah.
And overclocking and undervolting are related because in overclocking, you typically overvolt, which means you give it a higher peak, so the ones are higher and the zeros are lower. I know that's not the best technical description. Well, exactly. It goes up to 11. But what this does is when you juice the chip, it's able to usually sustain higher clock speeds than it normally would. So the risk with undervolting is you could destabilize the chip at its default voltage. But Intel usually is so conservative with these things, with these settings, usually you can under or overvolt them at least 10 or 20% without too much danger. Yeah.
Well, here's how I discovered this. So I have a MacBook, the little one, Air, MacBook Air, which I got because the old MacBook, well, I got it because it was sexy. But actually, I got it because the old MacBook Pro that I was using was just getting really, really hot in my lap, and it was heavy, and it just wasn't a nice way to watch video, to watch either downloaded movies or whatever.
Right.
And, you know, like sitting in the living room. So I got the Air because everybody said, oh, cooler, lighter, smaller. It was true. It was not cooler. And, in fact, the first phenomenon I noticed is that the videos would play for about 5 minutes and then just start stuttering like crazy. Like you'd get one frame per second all of a sudden, and it just the audio wouldn't keep up with the video.
You know, it's funny you mention this because on my laptop I had podcast number one, and I was just listening to it to compare sound quality and stuff. And you actually talked about this because I remember talking about that, and you actually did mention it on podcast one. The reason I was thinking about it because on Twitter, Will Shipley was complaining that he has an Air and he had to blow on the back or on the bottom of it to get the second CPU core to come back because it was
Okay.
It was like a Nintendo cartridge where you have to blow on the cartridge before you plug it in.
I can't get Will. I'm trying to find Will Shipley. If any of you knows Will Shipley, please tell him to call me because we want him to speak at our conference. And I have about 1,000 things to tell him. And one of them is that I have the solution to the MacBook Air problem. So it was the video was – and then somebody said, hey, check if the CPU is overheating or something. And I found a little monitor that lets you put the CPU usage indicator in the menu bar, so it shows the percentage load on each CPU because it's two cores, so it's like two CPUs. And I started running that, and I noticed that whenever the video was stuttering, that was because one of the cores was shutting down. And then at first I assumed it was a faulty chip, and then I discovered that it will do that when it gets hot because that's a pretty quick way to cool down the chip, theoretically. And so for a while, I worked on the assumption that the problem with the MacBook Air is the ventilation, because it's got its ventilation slots are right on the bottom. And the only thing that keeps the ventilation slots from being completely blocked when you put your laptop on something is these little rubber feet, which are really thin. So if you put it on a perfectly flat surface, those ventilation slots on the bottom theoretically work, but they just weren't, and I wasn't able to watch video. So what I was doing is I was setting my MacBook Air up on two books with a gap in between them. So it was like standing like in between two books kind of perilously just so that vent would have at least an inch clear below it. And then I could sort of watch video, but not always. Even when I did that, it would overheat. And so finally I encountered this thing called Coolbook, which is just a little app that some guy in Sweden wrote that's impossible to understand, has a really difficult user interface that you have to sort of study. And it lets you change the voltage that the chip runs at. And it's not just one voltage, it's like multiple voltages. Like when you're going 1200 megahertz, use this voltage, and at 1400 megahertz, use that voltage. And so there's a whole bunch of different settings, and the voltages are things like 1.1, I think was the defaults were in the 1.1 area, and I got it down to about 0.95.
Right.
And I'm pretty sure it didn't stop crashing. And what happened is that the CPU started running much, much cooler, like 75 degrees instead of 100.
Yeah. Well, voltage, like I said, it goes up, I think, with the square of the voltage. So it has a huge – and that doesn't sound like a big difference, but it actually is.
Oh, it really was. And I think it'll probably – I mean, it'll make the battery last longer, not that I really care because I mostly use it at home. But also, it's just shockingly cooler. And so it's kind of weird. Like you said, you're right. The Intel is conservative, or I don't know if maybe it's the Mac hardware engineers that just assume, you know, different chips – you know, there's some variability in the chips, and some of them need – more voltage than others as they come off the assembly line. And
that's true as well. I think some of their newer chips, they do actually have a range of voltages they'll ship at, so they don't have to throw the chips away.
Oh, interesting. Well, my theory was that they, you know, they just set it to a nice high voltage that all chips will function properly at, instead of actually adjusting to the lowest possible voltage for the particular chip that they just made. And the net result is that, you know, even though they're being conservative, you know, which is worse, an overheating CPU? I mean, that's a failure too in one direction.
Right. Well, you talked about how aesthetically pleasing the bottom of the Air was, and one side effect that's of that, true. Unfortunately,
yeah.
is there's no ventilation holes, right? So it's sort of a challenge. But I think a lot of laptops have similar overheating issues where they don't ventilate well when they're actually on a lap, you know, because that's where all
the vents are down. Well, you know what? Not the ThinkPads. The ThinkPads, the ventilation is off the side. They work great. But anyway, back to this CoolBook thing. You run CoolBook. And it takes about an hour to understand the documentation because I didn't know anything about undervolting. And every time I tried to read something about it, it was like electrical engineering stuff. And the UI was just not intuitive, and I didn't understand what exactly I was editing and how I was controlling it, when it was going to save the changes and that kind of stuff. It was just not written that well. And then you had to like run a separate program that tested your CPU to make sure that you hadn't lowered the voltage too much to the point at which it was unable to, I don't know, compute the square root of pi. So that was all sort of incomprehensible. And it took about an hour of studying and fiddling around before I finally got it to work. And I got much lower voltages than it shipped with. And this completely solved my problem. And to test it out last night, I watched the entire Big Lebowski on Hulu.com, and it was fine.
you had to for testing. You didn't really want to.
No, I didn't want to. No, it's but you know, I did my duty, and it was great. But this UI is, you know, difficult to say the least. And you'd think that somebody at Intel could write an app that, you know, ran for about an hour and basically just tried lowering the voltage until it failed and then raised the voltage a little bit and just found the right voltage for every chip. And they just did this on the assembly line while these machines are being assembled. Or at the very least, make a download available so customers can run this and get their chips, because it really does increase the battery lifetime, and it really does reduce the temperature.
Well, right. Yeah, no, they do that. It's called binning. But I think it varies depending on, you know, what chips they're making, what the demand is. But binning is the process by which you take a given chip and you see, well, what speed will it run at, right? Because some chips just have fewer defects and actually run, you know, better at lower voltages. I mean, there's a lot of variability. You know, what point 4 or 5 nanometer now. It's like really, really tiny stuff.
So. So I know they did this with speed, but do they do this with voltage as well?
Well, sure, because the two are related, like I said. I mean, if you have a really good chip, it can run really fast at really low voltage, or really slow at really low voltage, right? Those things are related. But I think what happens is if they're building chips at a certain, you know, speed, they may not test below that because that's like their floor. They're like, okay, if it runs at this, we don't care. That's our lowest speed or whatever. I don't know if they go to the absolute floor. They might on laptop chips.
Yeah, but they didn't. Well, I mean, they clearly didn't in the case of the MacBook Air, and if they had, they would have increased their battery time a lot.
But they like to leave a lot of headroom. I mean,
yeah,
they,
maybe. I mean, maybe I'm going to load Excel one day, and it's just going to shut down, and the computer's going to panic.
The way you test that is, the way historically you always test that is you run this program called Prime 95. Which all it does, and it has a Mac version, I'm pretty sure. All it does is calculate prime numbers at varying sizes, and so you run two instances of it, one for each core. You have to run two copies of it, and that'll load it far beyond what most people will ever do to a CPU. So if it can survive dual Prime 95,
I have a stupid question now. Surely that there are some instructions on the chip. I mean, what if there's just some part of the chip? Am I being crazy here? Maybe I just really don't understand CPUs. What if there's some instruction that calculating prime numbers doesn't execute? Like some Intel machine language instruction. Some part of the chip just never lights up, and that particular part of the chip just happens to want more voltage than it's getting. It's like
That's not really the intent of the code. So the intent of the code is to make the CPU as hot as they possibly can.
Oh.
Because heat is what triggers these failures usually.
Okay.
So really, you're just exercising a particularly, I think the floating point part of the CPU tends to use a lot of power. Of all the programs you can run, that's one of the highest power consumption. Like, I have a little device that actually tells me how much power the CPU, the PC is consuming at the wall. And you can run all different kinds of programs and see, you know, which ones, you know, load the CPU the most as measured by power draw. And it's really hard to beat Prime 95.
Okay.
So yeah, I'm by no means an electrical engineer, and I apologize to anyone listening to this who is or knows one. I apologize. I have a very limited sort of enthusiast understanding of how this stuff works, but I have done this for a number of years, so
I
know what works.
Yeah. I do want to emphasize to anybody who's listening that I also misunderstood undervolting because I thought it was the opposite of overclocking, which it's not. Undervolting just means less voltage. You still run at the same speed. Yeah.
That's right.
So the chip is actually – it's not like you're slowing down your computer in order to keep it cool, although you can do that too if you want to.
Yeah.
And in fact, one thing that the MacBook Air does not ship with, which is possible to turn on the chip very trivially, is when running on battery power and you don't have a lot to do, just turn off one core. So yeah. I think the way it ships the MacBook Air, you have, I think, 800 – 1,000, 1,200, 1,400, and maybe 1,600 as the speeds that it will go at. But you could set it, you could give it a 600 where it'll turn off one CPU and run a 1,200 or a 600 each or whatever.
Right.
I don't know what I'm talking about. You can make it run much slower and use much less voltage. Or maybe it doesn't. No, yeah, that would use less voltage. And you can do that whenever you just don't have enough load. And I guess they're probably... you know, I can imagine the Apple engineers thinking that they don't want to do that because that might reduce the sort of the multitasking feel of the system.
Well, one problem they would have with this approach is some CPUs may not actually tolerate lower voltages like yours does. You know, Intel rates them a certain voltage, and there's variability, right? Plus or minus 10, 20%.
Yeah, well, they should test that in the manufacturing process anyway.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
anyway, yeah. Will Shipley, there's your solution. Go install Cool Edit and waste half a day of your life configuring it.
But bear in mind, this is coming from the guy who advised us to drop the computer to fix it. So.
Hey, that worked. Was that on podcast?
Yeah, that was on the podcast. I think that was like one of the earlier first five we did.
That computer is still running.
I know. I'm just teasing you. I'm only kidding. So I had another
thing.
Also,
if you have a baby that won't stop crying.
Oh, no. That's not hardware. That's like software. That's a totally different topic, right?
5 inches off the ground onto a padded surface.
Yes. So another thing I wanted to talk about is I had a funny thing came across. So I have an ego search set up, I think like a lot of people do in Google. I think, I don't know if it's Google search or Google Blog. It's Google Blog search. But it just tells me when people are talking about me.
Yeah, and Google. That's awesome.
And I like to do that. I don't necessarily respond to everything because that's kind of creepy if you're the guy who's always responding to everything everybody writes about you. I think there was some guy in Usenet who used to do that, and they came up with a name for it, you know, like Godwin's Law, something like that.
What the heck was his name? It was like Scrid or something. It was something that could be grepped, and he used to just grep for himself.
Right, and then any time you invoked his name, it was like Beetlejuice. You know, he was poof, he was there. So I don't want to be that guy necessarily.
Shut up. What was that guy's name? That was funny. He would just show up in any Usenet group anywhere.
You realize that when I talk about this stuff, then I have to go research it. That's why it takes me so long to do these notes for the show. But I will have the link in the notes for the show of this guy.
Right.
But I do pick up some interesting things, and I enjoy reading them. And one thing I picked up, oh gosh, I guess it was over the weekend, was you'll like this one. And the title of it is, Don't Let Jeff Atwood Lead Your Web Project.
Oh, so, yeah. Marco.
It's, this guy, Marco Arment, who is the lead developer at Tumblr, which I like Tumblr. Tumblr's really cool. He also has some site Instapaper. And then he was also at this web search engine, Clusty, which we actually looked at. We were researching sort of the way web search engine worked and search results. Clusty would do clustering around like different vectors of a term like Jaguar. Like Jaguar could refer to Atari Jaguar, could refer to a Jaguar of the Big Cat, could refer to, you know, an OS 10 variant. It would do clustering like that. And I think Google kind of does a little bit of that now. I don't know what happened to Clusty. But it was a neat site. But what was frustrating for me about this post was that it's fine. I don't mind people criticizing me. In fact, if it's good criticism, what we call constructive criticism, then it's actually helpful. But I did not find Marco's post to be very constructive because there's like nothing in it that really explains what he thinks I'm really doing wrong. I mean, he sort of vaguely alludes to the fact that I sort of said negative things about PHP, which I don't think I actually did. What I was – I get a little frustrated with sometimes the way people interpret my posts because I wasn't really saying that PHP sucks. What I was saying is a good developer can write awesome stuff in anything, right? That whether the language is good or not ends up being kind of secondary to whether what you've created is actually good and interesting and useful or not.
Yeah, I have
that's
to agree.
The important factor.
Yeah.
And I wasn't really dissing PHP.
Yeah.
So I'm a little frustrated. So I had a little sound clip. I got Pamela hooked up, and I want to play a little sound clip as my response to that. So here we go.
Okay.
14 seconds. Does the rappers diss me? Say my rhymes are sissy.
Why exactly?
What? Why?
Be more constructive with your feedback, please. Why?
Why? So that's my excuse to
Flight
play
of the Concord.
Flight of the Concord. Be more constructive with your feedback. So that's
thank you very much, Brit.
Yes, Brit. Brit. Oh, my wife and I, we love the Concords. We're kind of actually a little bit obsessed with them now. They were in concert.
And
here.
I'm a New Zealander. So all those jokes like when he says Brit, no, Brit. You mean Brit? No, Brit. Because it's Brett, of course. With any New Zealander say Brit.
Yes, lots of love for the Concords. They had a concert here, but one problem with the Bay Area is a lot of the cool concerts like sell out like in seconds.
Right.
And they even had a second show, and they all sold out. And of course, they were scalped like crazy, which makes you hate the scalpers even more than you already do, and it's just unpleasant. But we didn't get to see the concert, and they actually played the Google I/O conference as well, which I was really bitter about that.
Yeah.
Because if I had known they were playing the Google I/O conference, I would have pulled strings to actually get me a ticket or an invite.
Were a couple of Fall Creek people went to that.
Yeah.
I heard it was great. I actually heard that was the best part of the conference.
That does not please me. I don't like hearing
it. Sorry.
But I do have I recommend the Flight of the Conchords album is available on Amazon MP3, DRM free, and I highly recommend it. I think it's hilarious. And also the show, which is on HBO, right? Flight of the Conchords.
Yep.
Excellent show. So but really, that was just an excuse for me to play Fly the Conchords. So I apologize, Marco. But I do wish you could tell me like why I suck. Like what am I doing wrong? Like,
yeah, no, I think it's just that you're helpful. Just generally an idiot. But then again, that's his opinion.
Yeah. No, okay. No. And it's a valid opinion, but it's like, okay, well, what specifically? I don't know. My analytical programmer mind can't let it go a little bit. You know what I mean? I get it on a personal level. It's like, okay, you don't like what I'm doing. That's fine.
Well, listen, if you're really searching, then search on my name and you'll find all these people complaining about how I interrupt you and I never listen to what you're saying and I'm the idiot. You're the wise one on the show. And that's fine because what's cool is the more – that's just going to make people listen to the podcast more. That's the way it is with podcasts. There is nothing more fun than listening to two people, one of whom you hate, one of whom you like.
That's true.
Doesn't matter which is which. It's just so much more fun than if you like them both or if you're – there has to be like one guy there that you just want to punch or you can't get emotional.
It's Joel. You should punch Joel. Joel is the guy. I'm your friend, Joel. I don't know. He's crazy. So
remember in the early days, we were talking about setting up some deliberate conflict debates just to make the show more interesting.
We could. Well, hopefully that's what the questions do. I mean,
yeah.
Yeah, hopefully. Hey, did you want to talk about you had the Fog Creek Management Training Program, the reading list? Because we had it on our list for a long time.
Yes.
And I don't have a ton of Stack Overflow stuff to talk about. I mean, we have a lot of progress on the site, but it's just been a short week, so it's tough for me to have a lot of topics at the top of my mind.
Yeah, and we didn't get a whole lot. To be honest, we did not get a whole lot of recorded questions this week.
Okay.
So we should talk about books.
Yeah, no, books are fun. We love books.
There was one book question. You still there?
Yeah, I'm still there.
Okay, I don't know. I clicked something and then I heard a click sound and thought I might have unclicked you.
No, I'm alive.
All right, forget that question. That's not really relevant. Let's see, the books, SMTP. No, that's not what I meant.
Yeah, it's the Fog Creek MBA curriculum.html.
Fog Creek MBA.
Curriculum.html.
Yeah.
There's a lot of books here, so.
Some of them are not that good. Okay.
Maybe what you should – I'm not going to read the list. What you should do is why don't you go down the list and just highlight the ones you think are interesting, and I'll make remarks as appropriate.
Where the heck did this go?
I'm still trying to find it.
Management Training Program books. Here we are. Reading list, software management training program. So there'll be a link in the show notes if you're missing this. And what I'm going to do is go through the list really rapidly and highlight the great ones and the random ones. And I'll explain why some of the things that are on there are on there. I can do this pretty quickly.
Wait, before we start. So this the intent of this book list is to support you guys have a management training program?
We do.
Okay. And so are these the kind of type of books like your average programmer should read, or just people with, you know, who want to ultimately run their own companies? I mean, what's the audience here?
There's a couple of goals for our management training program. The first is to take – I mean, our original goal actually was to take the kind of people that go to good schools, want to get into business, want to go get an MBA, and need to get some real-world experience before they can get their MBA. A lot of them go to management consulting for 2 years, and they do real drudgery. And they get paid nothing, and they get treated like crap. And the drudgery they do is just stupid, but they have to do it because they want to get into business school, and the business schools need to see a couple of years of real-world experience. Plus, the management consulting firms make those jobs sound extra, extra excellent. When they're recruiting on campus, they're always like, we have offices in Paris, London, Moscow, Sydney. And what that means is you will never go to Paris, London.
You'll be in Des Moines.
Yes, you are not going to Sydney because we have an office there. Where we don't have an office is Tulsa, and that's where you're going. Right. So those programs sound really great. We thought a lot of kids who are interested in that might be interested in something like this. What it turned out, we're learning slowly, but what it turns out is that the ideal candidate for our software management training program is a programmer that's been working for 5 to 10 years and has managed to be completely oblivious to the business side of software and really wants to move into management or start their own company, and they're just missing all this knowledge of everything that the suits do in their company. They never got it. They were allowed to just be coders. And so we came up with the program. It sort of started out as 3 years. It's now down to 2 years, where the academic component comes from going to school to get a master's in the management of technology. There are three programs in the management of technology in New York at Columbia, NYU, and Poly. So a couple people went to Columbia. The two people that are in it right now are going to Poly. They're pretty good programs. And then during their work hours at Fog Creek, they rotate through various different responsibilities, all of which are sort of suit-like in the company. So they'll rotate through sales, customer service, QA testing, program management. And they're usually given various semi-management tasks to work on.
And also
gets them a lot more experience with the software, with a not coding side of a software company.
And just to support your point, I have the minority opinion that being a software developer, the way to become a better software developer is not necessarily to, do all the coding you can forever, but also to complement those coding skills with also business skills, communication skills. So I believe even if you have no intention of starting your own company, I think it will better you as a programmer to study some of the business stuff. I mean, I know it's kind of a minority opinion, but I really believe that.
No, you're probably right. And in fact, I would even go so far as to say that a coder, a software developer, in the first 5 years or so of their career, and this number may vary radically, they acquire a set of programming skills that tend to sort of plateau. At some point, you're as good a coder as you're ever going to be. And after those, and it may be for some people, it may be 1 year, and they may be doing it when they're 19 because they started coding when they were 12. For some people, it may take more than 5 years. That obviously varies, but there is sort of a plateau at which point you sort of sit down and you write really good code. I remember after about a year of programming, I got to the point where the compiler never complained about anything I did. Like before that, it was like, how do I get the compiler to accept what I'm typing in it? Because I would just be making syntax errors left and right. I got to the point where pretty much I didn't make syntax errors. I started making logic errors, and that's one milestone. But you get, obviously, as time goes on, you get better and better, and you start. And one of the things that I've noticed is once you sort of, at some point, you kind of max out in how good code you can write. And then what tends to happen for a lot of people, and a lot of people have reported this, and I feel the same way, is that you actually get wiser about what you do. You do things in a more intelligent way the first time, but you also get slower about doing them. So, for example, it might take me a week to get around writing 8 lines of code. But those 8 lines of code that it took me a week to write are going to do what some other kid spent a week, wrote 800 lines of code with 33 bugs that he had to debug on Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. And so he'll wind up with, you know, hundreds of lines of code to do what my 8 lines did, just because I did it in kind of a more intelligent way. But I didn't have quite the stamina to just really bang away at it. So what I found is a lot of software developers, they sort of hit a plateau with their coding skills, and then they start doing kind of more and more intelligent things with code, but it's kind of, then that's the good thing, but on the bad news is they sort of have less stamina for coding, so they don't write as much code. And so their output tends to kind of level off, and that's just with the code. And so, Jeff, I think what you're saying, which I agree with, is that at that point you really need to start thinking about communication skills and business skills and econ and design skills and a whole lot of other things.
Writing code for a long time is its own reward. It's like you write code because you love to write code. And then eventually you reach a point where you're like, you love the code enough to write as little of it as you humanly can, right? You sort of let go a little bit of writing code for the sake of writing code. Because it is fun. It's really fun to build stuff. And that doesn't go away. But you start to ask, like, well, why am I writing this, right? That becomes the more important question than because we can write code. And it's always amusing to me how often I'll post stuff. And developers, it's like a knee-jerk reaction every time. It's like, well, the answer to this obviously is more code, right? Like, that's the answer to all problems that we have in the world. It's just, we just need to write more code to solve all these problems. And you start to wonder, like, well, does that really work? Does that really scale? Is that really going to solve the problem? I mean, that's sort of the way I look at it. And I still do love writing code. I mean, I really enjoy it. But I think you get a lot more perspective over time.
You also tend to find these, shortcuts. You're always trying to think, how could I do this with less code, or how could I reuse some other thing that already exists as a way to do this thing?
Yes, exactly. So let's go down the list. This is a great list.
Okay, here we go. Some of you have read some of these books. There's The Mythical Man Month, which is kind of famous. Everybody's read that, right? I mean, it's really sort of gives you a basic understanding of what it takes to get a development team to work together. And mainly the problem that book gets into is that adding people doesn't necessarily help make things come in on time.
That is the one true classic book, I think. I think everyone should read it.
Yeah.
You should just have it. It's sort of like the Bible of software books. I mean, it was sort of the first major software book, and you owe it to yourself to read it if you haven't.
Yeah. I actually just gave it to my whole sales team to read. So let's see. Don't Make Me Think, Steve Krug. That's actually one of the better books about user interface design that gets into some of the theory of user interface design rather than the practice. There's an awful lot of books that tell you, do this, don't do this, put this here, don't put that there. But underlying all of that is sort of this theory of people are malicious, stupid, and bored and don't want to deal with your app. And you really, and they're just not paying attention to what your app is doing, and you really have to make them, you know. So Steve Krug has a great book, and it's really about web usability, but it applies to all user interface design. So that's a pretty good UI design theory book. Growing a Business by Paul Hawken. This is the guy who created Smith & Hawken, which is a company that sells garden implements. But he's created a couple of companies over time, and he's really got a philosophy of bootstrapping a company, of growing slowly and cautiously without using large sums of capital, without taking major risks, and growing a business like you would grow a tree, which is very different than the Silicon Valley model. But it is the Fog Creek model of bootstrapping, so that's why that's on there. Now, this book, Deck is Dead, Long Live Deck, there's a bunch of books on here that I just picked because there were stories of high-tech firms, the origins of high-tech firms. And I, when I was starting Fog Creek, I just could not get enough of these books that were just like, here's the story of some stupid company that succeeded or failed. And just the more I read about them, sort of the more I learned about, you know, what should be happening. So there's a bunch of those in here, not all of which are necessarily worth reading, but some of which are. I'll call those out. I'll say, you know, this is just another story when I pass through them. Applied Cryptography, second edition. Probably only the first half of that book is really important. I think it is kind of important to understand what the algorithms are and what they can do and can't do.
You should be able to write them in C.
You don't have to be able to prove them. You should be able to understand that factoring a prime number is what all this stuff depends on, and you should be able to understand what it means to sign something, to digitally sign something.
Yes. No, the concepts are hugely important. I totally agree.
I mean, we use them all the time, yeah.
Yeah, and he has a number of follow-up books where his focus has kind of changed over time. He's sort of gotten into more of the human aspects of, you know, the algorithms can't save you when the people are stupid.
The interesting thing is that the first edition of Applied Cryptography has like almost a rant in there about how we really should replace cash with digital cash because it has the following properties. It's more anonymous. It's more secure. It's more – and that just makes you laugh. And I think he completely turned around on that one. But that said, you should know what it means to be public key cryptography. You should know how public key systems work. You should know what digital signing is. What hashes are for and why they work. Phil and Alex's Guide to Web Publishing, that's the one with the little guy sitting there with the dog. He really was a pioneer on the internet and on the web, and he has a very humorous and light style of writing that made that kind of interesting, although now it's kind of a historical piece. I don't really know how important it is anymore.
I want to give that one a shout out because I actually bought that one because I saw people talking about it and I was surprised. You're right. It's totally outdated in terms of the actual content, but it's still a really compelling read, which surprised me. And he also pioneered the style of something that I'm very ambivalent about is sort of like text interspersed with like random photos, which I...
Well, he's a photographer.
I know, but like I don't know. It's just I like the picture.
You know what? If he hadn't have done that, nobody would have... known who he was.
It works for him. It works for him. I will say that. I love that book, even though it's...
He wrote Travels with Samantha. Sorry to interrupt. When he wrote Travels with Samantha on the web, that was the first website you could go to where there was a person telling you a story and showing you pictures.
Right. That book is worth getting. It really is. You can get it for nothing used, and it's a really fun read, so I do recommend that one. That's all.
Yeah. The style... I mean, I sort of copied the style of putting random pictures in, obviously, and I think that it actually makes people... Honestly, I feel like half of the success of Joel on Software is using a slightly larger font and having pretty pictures. just make the whole experience. Okay, Sam's book, Testing Computer Software. This is the classic book of what software testers do. And it is a well-written and clear survey of the field of what software testers do. And if you most software testers are not trained in software testing. I don't know if there is such a thing as being trained in software testing. And so this is the book that you throw at them and they read it and they're like, okay, now I had to know how to do my job.
Cool.
Design for Community. Derek's book is one of the only books about like how to do UI design such that communities can get created. Have you read that one actually?
I have not. I've never heard of this book actually.
Oh, well, that's sort of one of the classics since we are designing for community. Now, it's a little bit, I'm trying to remember why I'm not so excited about it. Yeah, I'm half-hearted excited about it. It's a half-good book. I think that it doesn't really cover, it doesn't really touch on all the points of how to design for community, and it's a little outdated, but this is a guy that was building web communities and shares his experiences, so there's a lot to learn from it. Let's put it this way. It's not quite, you know, Clay Shirky's new book, Here Comes Everybody,
right,
is sort of supersedes this a little bit.
So, yeah, right.
Version control with Subversion. That's just on there because if you've never encountered version control, you should understand how it works.
One alternate there is Eric Sink had a great series on source control. And, you know, this is a guy who wrote a source control system, so he knows it right inside and out, which was awesome. I think he eventually published that. I got to look up how. I would almost recommend Eric's stuff as just, you know, here's what source control is. Here's what source control is supposed to do for you.
Yeah.
That was just, you know, a brilliant set of writing.
If source control and you know about it, just ignore that. Now, the Non-Designer's Design book is awesome. It's written by a designer who happens to be named Robin Williams. It's not that Robin Williams. And she is a, I think, Santa Fe-based graphic designer. And she's written a couple of books on the general topic of here's how you design stuff, and here's that, and mostly about how the page should be designed. But it all applies to the web, to any kind of graphic design you do. And again, it's some very simple principles that you can apply to making things look better, like just lining things up, things like things should be lined up.
And this is another point where, as a programmer, it's like, oh, I don't have to do any of that design stuff. Somebody else does that. I think as a developer, you really should know basic design principles too. Like, you should know enough not to make a page that looks, you know, just like a GoDaddy.com, for example.
Well, I think programmers are very frustrated by that because they think it's an artistic thing that they've never been taught how to do, and they don't think of themselves necessarily as being artistic or having artistic skills. And actually, the great thing about Robin Williams is she shows you some of the underlying principles here of how to of how this stuff works in a way that is completely understandable to a programmer, because it's almost like algorithms that you follow, and right. your pages look better and things look better designed.
Great book. Highly recommended.
The Pragmatic Programmer. Yeah. Say something about that. I can't remember what the heck goes on in that book.
Well, it's just a classic set of guidelines for programming without, you know, pulling your hair out. Basically, like, some of the classic concepts that people write blog posts about to this day, like, don't repeat yourself, broken windows. You know, Andy and Dave, the Prag Prog guys, were really the first people to really talk about this stuff, like in 2000. I mean, it shows you how young our craft really is when we're talking about the first people to publicize this were in the year 2000. That was, like, you know, 8 years ago.
Yeah.
And now this is considered classic material, and for good reason. Like, if you read the Prag Programmer, you'll be, like, nodding your head, like, every five pages. It's a lot of really good collected wisdom expressed in a very down-to-earth way. It's very complementary to Code Complete, I think.
Yeah.
I would recommend them almost side by side.
Yeah, or what about the Robert Glass book, Facts and Fallacies of Software Engineering?
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
A lot of the same topics.
Yep. Another great, great book.
Yeah, Robert Glass is somebody that, you know, a lot of people, I hesitate to say our age, have not heard of, because he's really the previous generation's Jeff Atwood. From
and you give by, me too much credit. That's okay. Way too much credit.
Two previous generations, combination of Joel Spolsky, Jeff Atwood, and Paul Graham, all put together.
Right.
I want to scroll back a little bit. Measuring and Managing Performance in Organizations by Robert Austin. Something that I'm a big believer in. That when you try to measure people's performance, individuals' performance, and you try to do these scientific experiments, where you're like, if we do this, what will be the result? The people are self-aware, unlike things that you normally do scientific experiments on.
Same machines.
Yeah, same machines or chemistry experiments. You try to do these chemistry experiments, and the chemicals don't know what you're doing, but the people do. And so his thesis is that when you try to measure performance in organizations in order to get better results, for example, you decide to start paying programmers for not creating bugs, and you think this will make better code, then for a very short period of time, you actually get the results that you wanted for a short period of time. But very rapidly, the people figure out how to game the system and how to get the measurements that you want while maybe doing something that is perverse for the organization. So this is – I could go on this for hours and hours and hours, but luckily Robert Austin already has. And this is a book that's fairly academic. He's a professor at Harvard Business School. And it's on a subject that it's just hard to find a lot of people that believe in this. So that's a good book to read. The reason I put Paul Graham, Hackers and Painters, there's some good stuff in there. The best thing is Why Nerds Are Unpopular at the beginning. And I think an understanding of the nerd personality type is fundamental to dealing with people in the software world. Right. I think that's really one of the kind of there is a personality type that is extremely common among great programmers, and understanding that personality and putting that into context is probably the most critical thing for a person who wants to manage programmers to do.
Right, and Paul gets a lot of experience with that, being that he's running, you know, Y Combinator and dealing with all these young software entrepreneurs. So.
Yeah, and I think probably that essay is what got him his audience, which is what gets him so much attention of people that apply to Y Combinator.
Right. Yeah, a lot of his early essays are really classic, so mm-hmm. definitely worth reading.
Let's see. Competing on Internet of Time is just another one of those, like, here's what was going on. Read some. It's another one of those, history of a business, kind of. The whole concept of Internet Time turned out to be false. So maybe that book, I really should delete that book. You know, there was this idea that they said of Internet Time, of things going fast, and you look how, you know, because Netscape 1 came out and then Netscape 2 came out. And you know what? Any software product that you work on, the first few releases come out very quickly because there isn't a big installed base and a lot of backwards compatibility. You can just sort of knock things out, and you can actually add features very rapidly to a new computing system, which you just cannot do when that system is more mature. So I don't think there was anything about the Internet that made there be a short release cycle. I just think that was like just a complete fallacy.
Right.
So forget this.
Okay, we'll skip that one.
There are some sort of internal, like what happened at Netscape, stories that are interesting. The inmates are running the asylum. Alan Cooper, famous UI expert, has written a lot of books about user interface design. All of them are good. This is one of the best. He does manage to squeeze more words into fewer thoughts than anybody else I know. He really does cram the words in there.
Well, hey, did you notice that the newer editions of About Face, there's been three versions of About Face now, and he keeps adding authors, but it makes it better because it sort of dilutes some of the Cooperisms that we've sort of – yeah. So I will say get newer editions of the Cooper books, particularly About Face, because he adds authors, and it really does help the book when there's more than one author in his case. Although Cooper is great, but there's there's such a thing as too much Cooper, definitely.
Yeah, he's saying the right things. You just kind of have to speed read to get them at about the right speed.
Yeah, kind of likes to bludgeon you with it.
Donald Norman, The Design of Everyday Things, he's the mother of all UI design books, and this was even before there was UI design. Right. This book, The Design of Everyday Things, which I believe was renamed The Psychology of Everyday Things. That's the same book.
Oh, that's right. That's right. They did. And just a classic. There's nothing really else to say about it other than it's just truly a classic. So
he talks about things like what makes a door work. Why are some doors easy to go through and some doors seem to confuse people? Stuff like that. That really is very similar to UI design, but he was talking about this before there was that much UI. And so this book has examples like a clock radio that's hard to use.
But, you know, that made me feel good reading that, though, because I figured if I can't get software UI to work, then there's people who can't get door UI to work. That made me feel a little bit better about what I was doing because I figured, okay, the software is a little harder than a door. So if it's hard to get a door right, imagine how hard it is to get software right with all these buttons and dialogues and things. So, yeah.
All right. The difference between God and Larry Ellison, just another insider account of Oracle. How Bill Gates fumbled the future of Microsoft, just another insider.
Wait, we can't just gloss over the difference between God and Larry Ellison. That's probably my favorite technical book title. It is hilarious.
Yeah.
And Larry Ellison is – I don't know if you know much about Larry Ellison, but I'll link his Wikipedia article, I guess. But Larry Ellison is kind of a strange guy. I think he fancies himself like sort of literally like a tech ninja. He's a very strange guy and worth reading about. He's quite a personality.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's all.
So anyway, the subtitle, The Difference Between God and Larry Ellison, is that God doesn't think he's Larry Ellison. Get it? Ha ha. Okay. That's actually the title of the book. But you know what? I just put it on there because pretty much anything that was the story of a software company or an internet company, I just threw in here. Similarly, how Bill Gates fumbled the future of Microsoft, a lot of insider stuff about Microsoft. I think it was taken from those emails that they had to submit in some antitrust case. Linus Torvalds, Just for Fun, his story about creating Linux. On a Roll by Howard Jonas is the story of IDT, which was an early internet service provider. And again, just another story of an internet startup. The First 20 Million is always the hardest, is actually a novel about a fictitious software company or hardware company or something in the Valley. You can skip it. It's just another thing to read if you want to know how Silicon Valley works. And it's in the form of a novel, which makes it in some ways more true that nonfiction story, because when you're telling a fiction story, you're limited to the facts. But when you're making up a novel, you can come up with the exact facts that you want that most closely correspond to the general truth.
Right. And hey, complimentary to that, have you seen the documentary Startup.com?
That's not a bad one. Yeah, that's a good movie.
I would maybe add that because that shows some of the pathology of some of the early web bubble stuff. It's amazing. So
it's kind of insane. But I mean, you know what? I don't think that was unique to that period. I think a lot of companies start with that kind of hubris and that kind of misunderstanding and the kind of overhiring and all those.
But the reason I thought about that is because you said, you know, you couldn't make this stuff up. It seems fake. Like you're watching, this is truly a documentary. This stuff all happened. These are real people. And you would swear it's like a reality show where everything is sort of semi-scripted and not really. But it's astonishing. I'll link it in the show notes. But yeah.
All right. So Random Access is the story of Corel, which is a Canadian-based software company that made some photo editing software for Windows before Photoshop was available for Windows. And now they bought WordPerfect and stuff. But it's just sort of the history, the rise and fall of that company. It's a very hard book to find. You can get it like used in bookstores in Canada and stuff. I don't even know if it was published in the United States, so it's tricky to get. But again, it's just another story of a software company. Showstopper by G. Pascal Zachary is the story of creating Windows NT version 1.0, which they called version 3.1. But it was version 1.0, and it's just basically the story of creating a new operating system, and it's fantastic.
It is. It's really good. And, you know, Dave Cutler, the primary architect, was just this fascinating guy. I love the sections on Dave Cutler because he's sort of the anti-Unix guy. And it's weird to me to think that there's basically only two operating systems in the world now. There's pretty much everything is either Unix or Windows NT based, which is based on, I think, VMS, which is what isn't that
well,
right?
Wait, it's not based on it. It's it was written from scratch. A lot of the underlying philosophy takes some things from VMS. For example, the concept of objects that it uses is from VMS. The concept of access control lists is from VMS. But it really was a from-scratch operating system.
Right. And is anyone even building that anymore? Do you think there will ever be another operating system in our lifetime that matters?
Yeah, people make them all the time. Oh, okay. That matters.
Well, that ends up getting significant market share. I don't know. But anyway, fantastic book. Really highly recommended.
The Leap is just a guy who made an internet company called the Home Portfolio, which is this website where you can find, like, let's say that you're looking for a faucet for your bathroom renovation. They will have all the faucets there. And it's just sort of, you know, one of the stories about one of these crazy .com companies. They maxed out their credit cards. They spent a lot of time talking to VCs. Some of the VCs were stupid. Some of them were smart, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, Digital Hustlers. What the heck is that about?
If you can't remember, then that's not good.
Yeah, don't get that one. Wait, let's see. Let's look. Let's zoom in on Amazon and see what it says here. Living large and falling hard in Silicon Valley. Oh man. Oh, you're Silicon Alley.
You're not even in Silicon Valley.
It's Silicon Alley.
Oh, Silicon Alley. Yeah.
Okay, I have no idea. This is just another one of those books that you read to get some of the insider knowledge, and you don't have to read them all. In Search of Stupidity, Rick Chapman's book. He wrote this great book about basically why the first generation of software companies all fell to Microsoft. So here's why Lotus fell to Microsoft, and here's why WordPerfect fell to Microsoft, and here's why Novell fell to Microsoft. And his general thesis, which I tend to agree with, is that it wasn't that Microsoft was so smart. It's that all these companies made some critical, crucial, and easily pointed to mistake. There was a goof in all these companies, and Microsoft just didn't make that mistake, and then won by default practically because they didn't make the mistake. So some funny stories about what happened, really mostly around the first gen of PC software companies: Ashton, Tate, Novell, Lotus, that kind of stuff. Startup is a very is an older book. It's about a company. A Silicon Valley VC-funded startup that was created called Go to create a tablet computer before anybody knew what a tablet computer was, before they even really had laptops. It was an abject failure. But again, a lot of the insider stuff, what goes on in typical VC-funded, typical Silicon Valley companies, even though it's very old, it's really completely contemporary in terms of, you know, the what goes on and stuff.
Well, you know, pen and touch and stuff is one of those things that's taken 15, 20 years to catch on. I remember all those really early infatuations people had with pen computing. Remember that?
Well, they
like,
thought
even
that
now, we still don't have it.
The theory was that the old business people would never type because they have secretaries to type and they never learned how to type. They didn't want to type. Mm-hmm. And so pen was supposed to alleviate that. And then there was the niche of the UPS driver and and the doctors walking around. But mostly the theory was the older business executives. And lo and behold, they retired, and the next generation knew how to type. And that was
but
that.
But you'll still meet people that are really into, like, there's a bunch of really cool tablet features in Vista. Like, many features in Vista, almost nobody uses them, right? But they're actually pretty cool. And people who use them, like, swear by them. They love tablets. They wish every laptop was a tablet. And we're still not really there yet. So, anyway.
And we may never be. Okay, PeopleWare, enough said. Best book ever.
Yep, great book.
I don't think there's anybody listening to this podcast.
Yes.
If you have not yet read PeopleWare,
what are you doing? Do not pass go. Do not collect $200. Go straight to your favorite bookstore and buy it. Yeah,
I probably should just be first on this list because it's just the ne plus ultra, the ultimate Bible, the source of all knowledge, which is that software management is about people.
Right. And I would also advise people to spider down the book list. DeMarco and Lister have written other books that are also very good. So if you like people where you think it's classic, you know, walk the list.
Yeah.
Read some of their other stuff.
The Macintosh Way is Guy Kawasaki, one of his early books. He's written a lot of books, but this is in the early days. You know, he was the evangelist for Macintosh. And by being an evangelist, I think he made up that word. I think pretty much it is fair to credit him with the concept of tech evangelism. the idea that you are almost a religious leader trying to get people to adopt your religion.
Yep. And anybody who does any kind of evangelism, that's always the spiritual godfather is Kawasaki. He was really the first to do it.
The book is great. Microsoft Rebooted, yet another inside Microsoft book. Speeding the Net, yet another Netscape book. AOL.com, there you go. There's the story of AOL. .bomb is the story of an e-commerce company in the first dot-com boom that was just sort of a hysterical laughing stock failure. there was a time when all dot-com companies were failing and some of them got written up and at least they got a book out of it.
I'm kind of glad I wasn't in California for that because I think it would have been bad. I think it was bad for most programmers. That's one thing I don't like about that.
Dot-bomb was interesting because they were in Virginia or something, so they didn't. They didn't even have the benefits of. They were actually in your hometown. They were in Charlottesburgville.
Charlottesville.
Charlottesville. Really? Yes.
Okay, that's where I went to. I went to the University of Virginia, so I spent some time in Charlottesville. Interesting. Maybe I'll.
It was a company called Value America, and I'm almost certain that it was in Charlottesville.
Interesting.
Yes.
I will look that one up.
Company. The new thing. The new thing by Michael Lewis is the story of not Netscape, but what was next? No, maybe it was Netscape.
I've heard the title, but I don't know this book.
It's basically the story of Jim Clark, who created Silicon Graphics and Netscape.
Right. Jim Clark, yes.
Right. Oh, I know what it was. This was this book about this company that he was starting called Healthion, which was a failure.
Right.
But anyway, Burn Rate is the story of a New York-based internet entrepreneur or journalist turned entrepreneur turned journalist. Yet another like inside story of a startup that's sort of tech-related, so that's why it's on there. Accidental Empires, Robert Cringely, is basically the great classic story of how Microsoft got to be Microsoft.
I love Cringely. He also has two videos, Revenge of the Geeks. Oh, gosh, I've linked to it before. But there's a video series that's very complimentary to this book where he talks about the history. And it's about the time Windows 95 was launched. That's when he filmed it. But I love Cringely. He's still around. He still writes his columns.
That's a different human, but it's the same name, yeah.
It's a different person?
Yeah.
You're kidding me.
Yeah, they switched. It's like Bewitched.
This is so uncool.
Yeah.
Okay, I did not know that. I'm disturbed. But anyway, proceed.
It was Robert Cringely was originally like the rumors column in the back of one of those weekly computer magazines. It was either PC Week or InfoWorld, I forget. And they had this the rumors column, and they didn't want to take they wanted it to appear to be anonymous, so they had this made up name Robert Cringely, and there was some kind of dispute over who got to keep the name. And the current one is not the same as the old one. Revolution in the Valley is the history of Macs. Good book, lots of pictures, a lot of fun.
Just to interject, we're probably going to run out of time here. So what I would do at this point is just pick the ones that you really like in the last quarter of the list.
Oh, geez, but we're having so much fun.
I know, but it's an hour, so.
Okay.
There's a lot of good books. This is the lesson, is that we do love books. I mean, Stack Overflow is about, people don't read anymore, and yet there's so many fantastic books, right, that you never have time to read them all.
These are all good. You have to read all these, I'm sorry. Yeah, you pretty much have to go back and read all these.
They're all that good.
Well, I mean, they're all useful. There's only category I would say is that there's a handful of these that that are just more. There's a bunch of these. And I'll just list them that are just more stories of inside companies. There's the inside story of Ben and Jerry's, which is a great bootstrapping example. Microservices is a made up story, but it captures something about the life of a programmer. The Art of the Start, that's another Kawasaki book, so maybe you don't need all of them. The Business of Software, Ran a Walk Down Wall Street. 21 Dog Years is sort of a story of inside Amazon from the trenches. Inside Intuit is the story of Intuit. Direct from Dell is the story of Dell. Amazonia is another inside story about Amazon. The PayPal Wars is the inside story of PayPal. The Search is about Google. High Stakes No Prisoners is about this company Vermeer, which was bought by Microsoft and became FrontPage.
FrontPage.
So those are all those are all, like, you don't have to read every single one of those, but it's kind of, if you're doing a startup, it's nice to know what went on at other startups just to get a benchmark and get a feel for what kind of mistakes you can make and make you feel less lonely. And so the more of those you read, you know, the better, but you don't have to take them very seriously. Everything else here is really like a lot of these books that I have down here are like the key introduction to a particularly important thing that you need to know about. So, for example, The Goal and Critical Chain are about a particular way of looking at the theory of constraints, which is sort of an important business concept. The Goal talks about it in a manufacturing context, like how would you make a manufacturing plant, or a Critical Chain talks about it in a way that is actually relevant to software schedules. So those two books are pretty important business concepts. The Around and Walk Down Wall Street is probably the most important book you can ever read about personal investing. Crossing the Chasm is a pretty important book about marketing. 4 Days with Dr. Deming is just a great look into the methods of management developed by somebody who is a guru to many.
Yeah, Deming is very, very famous in business circles. I know that name.
And then I would skip the E-Myth Revisited is sort of important. An important concept for entrepreneurs. The E-Myth is this idea that if you're a great programmer, you should be able to make a software company. It's important to realize that making a software company is not being a programmer. It's something else. And so the E-Myth Revisited, you know, starts with a little, I don't know if it's a true or an apocryphal story about a woman who's in a pie shop and she's made a pie shop and she feels like she's an entrepreneur, but she's sweeping the floors and making pies all day and that's all she has time for. And the important thing to learn is you can't be making the pies. You have to be making the system so that the people can make the pies so that you can scale.
Right.
Because if you can't scale, you're just working in your business. You're not working on your business.
Right. Like if you're the CEO and you spend all your time programming, that's kind of a failure mode in and of itself, which is a hard pill for people who love programming to swallow. But this is what I was getting at earlier as well.
And then the next four of what's left on the page here, the four most important to read are The Psychology of Persuasion by Robert Cialdini, which is universally known as just Cialdini. That's what everybody calls that book. It's called Influence. It's about five techniques that people use to influence other people. And it is basically the heart of all marketing and also the heart of all scams. And it's important to protect yourself and understand the methods that people use to get you to comply with their requests and their desires. And that's a very, very important book for everybody to read. So that's one. I said there are four. Getting to Yes is probably the best book you could ever read about negotiating. The Little Red Book of Selling is a great book about selling, about doing sales. And if you only read one book about how to do sales, that it should be that. And How to Win Friends and Influence People is something I would just recommend to everybody. It's a bizarre title. Everybody's like, what? How to Win Friends and Influence People? What is this, some kind of goofy? And it's a really, really ancient book. I mean, it's from the 20s.
Like the 30s. Or 30s. Yeah.
A
really long time ago.
But it's unbelievable. I mean, I give it to literally every salesperson and every software management trainee on their first day. And they read that and they say, you know, I thought this was going to be some kind of cheesy kind of thing. But there's a reason this has been a bestseller for 80 years. I mean, it really is incredible how there is a science of how to win friends and influence people.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's not gamey. It's more like just like be good to the people around you, which I don't think it hurts to remind people of that. So it's really based on just, you know, being a good person, really.
It's not at all manipulation, and it's not stuff that you would have thought of, and it's stuff that geeks tend to be particularly bad at, and they wonder why other people are so good at making friends and influencing people. And then you read this and you say, well, here's 17 concrete things you can do, specific steps you can take.
A, remember people's names. That's always a good one. It's simple stuff. It's algorithmic, right?
Yeah.
And the polar opposite of this book would be a book like – there's all these crazy books on dating where it's like The Game. It's like how to manipulate women into liking you or manipulate the opposite sex into liking you. This is not at all like that. Those books are really evil and wrong. Yeah. This is not like that. This is the good spectrum of those kind of books, and you should read it for no other reason than that, actually.
Yeah.
You know.
So there we go. I guess we've gone through a lot of this. We're we're sort of out of time. Everything else on here is some of these things like essentials of accounting. It's like, you got to know how accounting works. You have to know what double entry bookkeeping is. This is one of the better books I've found that explains it in a clearer way. But if you have another one or if you already know about that, that's okay too. It's not the most superbly classic book.
Right. Just branch out into whatever you're interested in. I mean, follow your interests, obviously. But I think my point is to cultivate interests that aren't all related around programming, but you know right. related things, the things that take you in slightly different directions but are still related to programming. So that's a lot of the message that I sent out on my blog for sure.
So if I had to, I'm going to go through this list one more time, and I'm just going to call out like the ones that are important things. Is if you're an entrepreneur, if you're starting a high tech company, the most important ones that you probably haven't encountered. You've probably already seen some of these. Some of these are just filling you in. But don't make me think, really important for understanding UI. The Non-Designer's Design Book is really important for understanding design. Facts and Fallacies of Software Engineering is one of the great, cover some of the things that you probably don't know about software engineering. I'm just skipping through to try to find the ones that PeopleWare is not missable. The Secrets of Consulting, I didn't mention this earlier. That's a good one, but you can miss it. Unless you want to do consulting, if you're a software consultant, you can.
Yeah, the Weinberg books are great as well.
The 22 Immutable Laws of Marketing, that's pretty much, if you have to read one book on marketing. Well, no, if you have to read one book on marketing, read The Psychology of Persuasion by Robert Cialdini. That's probably better. And Getting to Yes, because you probably do have to do negotiation. You're going to have to negotiate with people in zero-sum games. And Dale Carnegie.
Right. No, it's a good list. I'll definitely summarize it in the notes. So do we have any other things we want to say before we go?
Okay. Is that going to be boring? Is this going to be the most boring podcast we ever had?
I find it interesting. I mean, I don't think so. I find the book list very interesting. I like to read books, and I think a lot of people that read my blog like to read books, so I think it's fine.
Okay.
So
what would be you've read some of these, which is and we both agreed that PeopleWare is sort of a big highlight, but what would be your second book to tell everybody that everybody must read?
Well, I think Don't Make Me Think. I mean, that's probably my number two book of all time. So
okay.
If you haven't read that, definitely read that. But to me, the interesting thing about this list is the more business-oriented stuff, like how to negotiate, how to do marketing, stuff that as a programmer, you're not necessarily have a burning desire to learn, but
right.
I think it's very complementary to what you ultimately do. So it's about branching out.
It's kind of weird. What I've discovered is there's so many fields where there is one book that is so much better than all the other books in the field. And it's recognized that way, and it sells better. For example, in the field of investing, the Mythical Man Month, there's always just one book that stands head and shoulders above all the other books in the field. And it's the obvious one to read if you want to learn about that field. And then there's about a million other little books that you can fill in your knowledge later. But the big classics, and I've put a lot of them on here.
Right. So resist the urge to just code nonstop. I mean, put down the compiler for a minute and learn about some other aspects of the world that are related to this universe that we code in. So I think that's the message maybe of this particular podcast. So
all
Joel,
right.
How are we doing on transcriptions? Are we
good? Transcriptions. We're good, I think.
Okay, excellent. I want to extend my invitation. If you want to be in the private beta, I'm not really accepting people in anymore, but if you do a little bit of transcription work, and again, it's the honor system, I'm not really going to check up on you. We're all adults. Email me, and I'll be happy to invite you to the private beta. The private beta is still scheduled for this month. It's looking like it's going to be more towards the end of this month.
Wait, this month
but it should
July?
Still be this month.
Pardon Wait me. A minute. We've got to talk about schedules next week. But we're out of time.
We can talk about schedules next week. That's no problem. And then as we always do, please submit questions. I think we're a little low on questions, aren't we? Also, we want to urge people to...
you know what? Not a quick question. Think of something controversial for us to debate for next week. If you've got a controversial thing that you think me and Jeff will disagree on, then that's what I'm going to play. And what you do is you record a little MP3 or Ogg Vorbis, and you email it to podcast@stackoverflow.com. And we'll play it on the air. Try to keep it under 90 seconds. There's a thing called Blog Talk Radio you can use if your computer is not set up to record, like you don't have a microphone or something. Blog Talk Radio is a phone number you can call, and it'll set you up with an MP3 you can mail us. It's quite simple. Until then, we will see you next week.
See you next week.
You've been listening to Stack Overflow with Jeff Atwood and Joel Spolsky.
The Conversations Network is a 501c3 nonprofit, and we need your help. For a tax-deductible donation of as little as $5 per month, you can support this channel and the rest of the Conversations Network. So please visit conversationsnetwork.org to become a member and help us continue to bring our programs to the world for free. Our audio files are delivered by Limelight Networks, the high-performance content delivery network for digital media. The post-production audio engineer for this program was Joel Spolsky. Our website editor was Jeff Atwood. The series producer is Joel Cherney.
This is Phil Windley. I hope you'll join me next time for another great presentation from Stack Overflow here on IT Conversations.